Tonight we will discuss on Coast to Coast AM UFOs in wartime. Our special guest, Mac Maloney, with us. And stand by, back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back. And before we get into the interview, let me tell you about Mac Maloney, author of UFOs in Wartime, What They Don't Want You to Know. Mac grew up in the Dorchester section of Boston and was taught to read and write by the nuns at St. Anne's School. His father was a veteran of World War II, as mine was, and he used to read military books all the time, receiving a B.S. in journalism and a graduate degree in filmmaking from Emerson College. Went into work on some corporate type of jobs, and then Mac started writing books back in 1984. He's been doing it full-time since, and he's penned more than 35 to 40 books already. How many books do you have out there, Mac?
I'm not really sure, George. I think it's somewhere around 40, 42. You're supposed to stop counting after 20, but...
Well, good for you. You know, my mother was born in Fitchburg, which is about 50 miles west of where you were.
That's right.
She just loves it out there, and her sisters and brothers are still out there. I would go out there as a kid in the summer, and the thing I remember the most about that area, they used to have these little clam stands, like they have little McDonald's shops all over the place. It was just amazing.
Clam shacks.
Yeah. They were great. They were great. So tell me a little bit about you, Mac, beyond what I read in the bio.
Well, I've been writing military fiction for, as you said, about 20 years or so. We're counting 40 books and counting, I should say. And this has been my full-time job for a while. And we were just, I was at lunch with my editor one day, and we were throwing around ideas. And I mentioned to him that I was always interested in UFOs. And I had come upon this thought that it seemed to me from all the books that I'd read that UFO sightings spike during times of war or when we're preparing to go to war. And he said, you know, that might be an interesting subject for a book, a nonfiction book, which I hadn't done a nonfiction book in more than 20 years. So I looked into it, and, you know, we went through the whole process, and here we are 2 years later.
Well, I can tell you have a passion for this, and it's a great series of accounts that are in here, and we're going to digest them and go through a lot of these. I'm convinced that we've been visited. I mean, I just think too many people have seen too many things. I don't understand why yet, but I strongly believe that they're out there, they're coming here, and they've been coming here for a long time. You have gone back, I mean way back, for some UFO cases and possible examples to when? The Roman Empire days, don't you?
Right. Even earlier, we had a couple, we found a couple cases where Alexander the Great, when he was in the process of conquering the known world back around 300 BC, he was he had two instances where UFOs, you know, came into play with what he with one of his campaigns. Well, one of them was he was in eastern Persia and he was about to cross a strategic river. His army was made up of thousands of foot soldiers, but also lots of horses and war elephants. And just as they were about to ford this river, these, as his people traveling with him described them as flying shields, appeared and they began buzzing his army, and it to the point where they scared the war elephants and the horses, and the horses and the war elephants would not cross the river. And his campaign kind of came to a halt right there. 2 years later, he was laying siege to the city of Tyre, which is off of which is in present-day Lebanon, and it was it's a city that was built out in the harbor. And his troops were building a causeway out to the city to attack it. And these flying shields showed up again and began orbiting the city. And then one of them let out a lightning bolt, as the story goes, and destroyed one of the walls and allowed Alexander's armies to get in and to take the city. So that's our first one that we came upon where it was actually a wartime sighting of UFOs. And and then when we go to 300 A.D., Constantine I was in a battle, was about to do battle with a rival, and the prize was going to be who was going to control the Roman Empire. And his army was smaller than his rival's, but the day before, a UFO showed up over their encampment, and it was in the shape of a cross. He saw it, and a lot of the people in his army saw it, and that he took that to mean that he took that as a sign, and so what he did is he told all his warriors to put a cross on their shields, thinking if they did that, he would win the battle. Well, it turns out he did win the battle. about, you know, against all odds the next day, and he became the Roman emperor. And he, the first thing he did was make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And, you know, who knows what history would be like if that didn't happen.
That's true. How did you find these case studies from way gone back?
We just went, first of all, I had a lot of UFO books here, anyway, but I went out and I bought every UFO book that I could find that I think I hadn't read, and plus just did hundreds of searches on the net. And the idea was just to get as much information as possible and distill it down into the 70 or so episodes that we finally put in the book.
That's fantastic. Now, let's jump ahead just for a little bit about sightings during wartime in the 20th century. Do these craft, or whatever they are, do they get involved, or are they much like observers?
For the most part, they were like observers. The instances I just gave of Alexander the Great, those are the rare cases. For the most part, people see them either during wartime or when we're ramping up to go to war. I can give you an example of in 1909, there was a, for 1 year, they had the scare ships in England. And what that was people started seeing what looked like zeppelins flying over England, but they were moving very fast. They were moving about 200 miles an hour. They were they would fly against the wind. They had huge searchlights from the, on the bottom shining on the ground below. They were only seen at night. And as it turns out, the Germans did not have any Zeppelins that were capable of flying to England until 1914, and now we're in 1909. And people saw these things all over the place. But they didn't. They thought they were spy ships, but you don't spy with two big searchlights hanging from the bottom of your aircraft.
And these dirigibles didn't go that fast. They still can't go that fast, can they?
They go about 50 miles an hour these days. But
yeah.
The two British newspapers stationed reporters in two different cities, and the first reporter saw one, and then he started a clock going, and then the scare ship was seen 20 minutes later at another city, and by, triangulating, I guess you'd call it, they found out that the scare ship was going about 200 miles an hour.
God, that's unbelievable. So who called them scare ships?
The media, the British media really jumped on the story, and they coined the term the scare ships.
Well, that's probably a good term, but did that include early Men in Black stories?
Well, there is the earliest Men in Black story that we could find, of that nature was during the scare ship crisis. A gentleman who lived on a cliff looking out over the English Channel saw a scare ship one night, and then the next day he was out on his property. He found this strange object. He described it as a soccer ball with a metal rod shoved through it. He didn't know what it was, so he contacted the local authorities, and the Coast Guard and the British police came up and looked at it. They had no idea what it was, so they asked him to hold on to it until the British military could see it. So he did that, and in between the time that the British military actually came and saw the object and took it away, this man's servant, house servant, was going out one day, and she saw these two men dressed in black kind of hanging around his property. They were looking around the area on the cliff where he had found this object. Then they searched his barn where he had stored the object, and according to her, they, as I said, they were dressed in black, and they were speaking some strange language, and they scared her, and I think that she scared them a little bit, and they left the area. But it's funny how that, and then later on, lots of people started seeing these men dressed in black who would be always around areas where scare ships had been seen that night. So, who knows who they were, what they were doing, but really kind of an early Men in Black story there.
As we get into some of these case studies, Mac, we'll digest a lot of these different examples. But overall, what are you convinced? What do you think has been going on?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because I look at it as one huge puzzle, and we get a piece here and a piece there, but the puzzle has yet to come together. My personal opinion is that I think that whoever are in these craft are not necessarily extraterrestrials. I think that they may be time travelers who are coming back to see history as it's being made. There's a lot of evidence kind of leaning towards that.
Tell me more.
Well, for instance, to jump ahead a little bit to World War II with the Foo Fighters, I mean, there were reports where the crews of Allied bombers, British and American bombers, would see these fantastic aircraft flying right off their wing, 100, 200 feet off their wing, while they're on bombing missions, while they're dropping their bombs. These strange craft would be flying in formation with them and not interfering, not taking any kind of action or belligerent action or anything, just flying with them. And all I can think of is if you have a technology that you have an aircraft that can fly at 5, 6, 7,000 miles an hour or just disappear, you're moving so fast, why would you want to get so close to an airplane that's only going 300 miles an hour other than just to observe what's going on?
Well, that's true. I mean, and they were all sizes, weren't they?
All sizes, all shapes. A lot of the Foo Fighters were described as orbs of light, but others were, the British used to describe them as unguided rockets, believe it or not, but they were rocket shaped that used to, once again, fly in formation with Allied bombers. There were large craft that were seen with portholes, with beings looking out of the portholes. Just an amazing array of different shapes and sizes of Foo Fighters during World War II.
Why don't they seem to get involved in these world events? You know, in some cases, we've heard stories, Mac, that they've flown over missile silos and they've stopped or shut down launches just to prove a point. But overall, during periods of conflict, they don't seem to get involved. Why not?
Well, again, if we go to the time traveler theory, you know, that old paradox that you can go back in time, but you can't change anything. I think it might be something along those lines. Or I just really kind of see them as maybe, you know, historians coming back to see if coming back from our future to see history as it's being made. And they just stand off. They observe. They have this reason to watch us, you know, as we prepare or as we're killing each other during wartime. It's really kind of a strange situation, but I would like to know the answer. Maybe someday we will, but now I can only speculate.
You tracked down a case of a man who shot down or tried to shoot at a UFO in flight during what period? World War One.
At the beginning of World War One, when German Zeppelins were able to make it the round trip from Germany to London and back and drop bombs on London in 1914, the British Air Force had yet to come up with a way to shoot down Zeppelins. Later on, they would come up with a way basically putting incendiary bullets in their machine guns and lighting the Zeppelins on fire. But before that, all they could really do was send up airplanes at night as a kind of crude early warning system to at least let people know that a Zeppelin was on its way. So in this particular case, it was in January of 1914, a pilot was up in his basically unarmed plane, and he saw what he thought was a Zeppelin over London, but as he got closer to it, he described it as a railway car with lights and windows and lights and seeing, you know, beings within. And thinking it was still some kind of a German weapon, he took out the only weapon he had, which was a pistol, and fired at it. And as soon as he did that, this craft took off at tremendous speed. And it took off so quickly, he thought that he was disoriented, and he thought he was crashing, and he actually wound up crashing into a marsh. And as it turned out, that was the first instance that we found of someone shooting at a UFO in flight.
He's lucky it didn't annihilate him, Mac.
Right. Well, that's always a concern, too. I mean, that comes up later on in the 50s when there were so many UFO sightings, especially over Washington in the early 50s, that President Truman gave out a secret order that didn't stay secret very long. And what it was to all U.S. fighter pilots was, if you see a UFO, if you can't, quote unquote, talk it down, then you should shoot it down. And a lot of people, when that leaked out, a lot of people became very concerned because they said, maybe we shouldn't be shooting at these things because they seem to have such advanced technology, they could, you know, turn us into a crisp. So that was definitely a concern later on.
I've interviewed an Iranian officer and also Mac Torres, both the military people who were ordered in their planes to shoot at a UFO. And I don't know why we would order them to do that. Do you? That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. We have a story at the very end of the book where we kept coming upon this reports that a flying saucer was shot down by a U.S. Air Force F-16 during the first Gulf War. But that's only because the UFO shot at the F-16 first. And that was one of the very few instances we have in the book where the UFOs actually take some kind of offensive action. But I think it's very unwise to shoot at UFOs.
See, nowadays, I could understand how people would confuse a drone for a UFO. They must come in all sizes and shapes. But the ancient days, how do you explain that?
See, that's what I mean. You can't explain it. You can't explain it. People would see there's the typical flying saucer type UFO, cigar-shaped objects are also, you know, seen a lot. But there was also these cases where people saw things flying in the sky that seemed to be technology about 10 years too early. And like large planes flying over Scandinavia in the early 30s, for instance, the ghost rockets of Sweden in 1946, even the scare ships, once again, people thought they were Zeppelins. They looked like Zeppelins, but they didn't act like Zeppelins. So once again, it's another two, three pieces of this huge jigsaw puzzle that we just can't seem to put together yet.
Mac, what did people of that era, whatever era we're talking about, what did they think these objects were?
Well, many times with the scare ships, people were convinced that they were Germans. Whether the Germans had the technology or not, people were convinced that these were German craft. In the Scandinavian ghost flyers of 1933, people were convinced that they were German airplanes. And basically, the ghost flyers were in the late 1933, early 1934. People of the very desolate part of Sweden called Verbotten up in the Arctic Circle saw these very strange planes, huge planes, 8 engines, big tail boom for rear section, pontoons making a lot of noise, and just like the scare ships, having large searchlights on their fuselages shining down at the ground. And people thought, you know, they didn't know what they were, but they assumed they were German secret aircraft launching from an aircraft carrier somewhere up in the Arctic Ocean. The problem with that is that the Germans never had a working aircraft carrier. And even launching, and people saw dozens of these things at night, and even launching dozens of airplanes in the Arctic at night these days off a supercarrier would be, you know, a hard thing to do. Doing it back in 1933, 1934 would be very hard, but still, it's what the most logical conclusion, even though it wasn't a conclusion at all, was that they were German aircraft, both in the scare ships and of the ghost flyers. So people just assume it's some enemy spying on us, spying on them, you know, before war breaks out.
Tell me about some of the pictures and animation in the book. Where'd you get it?
Well, we found out, we tried to locate some really good UFO photos, and then we realized, you know, there aren't really any really good UFO photos, because if there were, we'd know what these things are, maybe. So I went to a friend of mine, Mike Dominic, who is a artist up in Nova Scotia, and I gave him some examples of some of the episodes in the book, and I asked him, you know, can you visualize what we're talking about here? So he put together 5 drawings that show the, you know, as we were just talking about, the ghost flyers, and also a few others where you can it was the closest we could come to putting you there, to actually giving you the visualization of what people were reporting back then.
Yeah, he did a good job, Mac. Stay with us. Mac's book, we're talking about UFOs in wartime, his website, Mac Maloney, M-A-C-K, MacMaloney.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com as well. When we come back in just a moment, we're going to talk more about some of these incredible stories of UFOs in wartime and why they do what they do. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Mac Maloney, we're talking about his work, UFOs in Wartime. Fascinating subject. Been interested in this since I was a kid. More with Mac when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Mac, let's go through some of these cases here. Let's get into the Scandinavian ghost flyers of 1934. Tell us about that.
Okay. I mentioned it briefly before. What happened was in the end of 1933 and the beginning of 1934, people in this very desolate region of Sweden called Verbotten started seeing these very strange airplanes flying over. And they were very large. They had 8 engines. They made a lot of noise. And they had 2 searchlights hung beneath their fuselage, shining the beams onto the ground. People started seeing them throughout this winter, and it's winter up there. I mean, it's dark up there for the entire winter. And they reported them to the authorities. The Swedish Air Force got involved, but the military was never able to spot one of these things, which was interesting. But they were spotted a lot by people on the ground. And they would do very strange things. They would do things like they would circle a village endlessly for all night long, which is really kind of odd because there are airplanes. I mean, even airplanes these days can't fly for 6 or 7 hours without being refueled, yet these large airplanes were doing it. People would stay out all night watching them and listening to them. They would also circle around railway stations and mountains and illuminating what was below with these large searchlights. Finally, people started seeing them over Norway and Finland as well. But as I said, the military was never able to catch up with any of them. And then, for that most of the year of 1934, they were showing up, and then they just kind of went away. As I said before, a lot of people thought that possibly these were German aircraft, but the Germans had no aircraft carrier to launch these things from. Even if they did, that ship would have to go back to Germany at some point and refuel and resupply, and that would mean there would be a break in the action of people seeing these things, but there never was. And it was just another baffling case, what was going on here. Once again, it looked like it was technology a little bit ahead of its time. I mean, there are no eight-engine airplanes, but it looked like just maybe an eight-engine airplane could have been built maybe 10 years later, but right, certainly not in 1933 and 34.
What about the possibility that there was a secret government program going on somewhere on this planet? I don't know what country, and that these craft might have been from that. Possible?
Well, I guess anything's possible, but, we have to look at the logistics of such a thing. Once again, the thing with airplanes is that they're limited by how far they can fly and they're limited by fuel. And the larger the airplane, the more fuel it consumes. So, if people saw there were dozens of these things, so where is the air base that can launch dozens of these huge airplanes? I mean, we were trying to do it in World War II with B-17s and Lancaster bombers in Europe and B-17s and B-29s in the Pacific theater. It's a huge enterprise. You need thousands of people to put hundreds of planes in the air. Where were these people? And at the end of once it was over, and let's say once World War II was over, or before World War II began, I mean, no one ever came forward and said, I was one of the ghost flyers, or, I helped put the ghost flyers in the air. No one ever revealed where any base was. So it's possible, but, where's the evidence?
Well, that's a good point. One of my favorite cases, you've studied it in detail, that 1942 case, UFOs over Los Angeles.
Right. It just an unbelievably baffling case, and it's really surprised that more people don't know about what happened. It was in February of 1942. We were just new to World War II. Pearl Harbor had just been attacked 3 months before. There was a lot of war jitters, especially on the West Coast.
People were paranoid, weren't they, Mac?
People were paranoid. People really thought that the Japanese were going to physically invade the West Coast. So Los Angeles at the time had 2 million people, and they had a lot of defense plants. And so they had a lot of anti-aircraft batteries around these defense plants. And there was a lot of military in the city and a lot of civil defense people in the city. So on February 24th, the day before, naval intelligence had told all these people, civil defense and military people in L.A., that there was a chance that the city was going to be bombed that night. So everyone was on alert. And sure enough, early the next morning, objects started showing up on radar and coming in from the Pacific, heading for Los Angeles. The air raid sirens went off, waking everybody. And then soon enough, the anti-aircraft batteries got targets and started firing at them. And for the next 2 hours or so, there was this incredible battle where tons and tons of ordnance were shot up into the sky. And lots of people saw these objects flying overhead. So much ordnance was shot up that, if you don't hit anything with an anti-aircraft shell, it comes down. 6 people were killed on the ground from falling ordnance.
Oh, my. And they heard pinging, didn't they?
Yes, they heard pinging. They seemed the objects were getting hit, but they had no effect on these objects. Many police officers and many reporters, we went to depth in the book with the reporters reporting on this incident that night, where they had them in binoculars and they were watching these things go over the city, but they definitely were in airplanes. In fact, there's a photo in the book, which might be the most dramatic UFO photo ever taken, It was taken by the Los Angeles Times. They gave us permission to run it in the book, and it shows a large flying saucer-shaped object caught in six or seven searchlights over Los Angeles as it's being fired upon by anti-aircraft fire. And it's a very, very dramatic photo. And why people don't know very much about this is that the next day, the Army and the Navy completely clamped down on it because they're under war censorship rules, and it gave them a lot of power to kind of just shut the story off.
Sure.
Even though the Army and the Navy disagreed, the Navy said nothing happened. The Army said, no, something was over L.A. We just don't know what it was. But then the story was just quarantined right then and there. But it's just an amazing story that, like I say, few people don't know about. And I think also the reason is that Steven Spielberg made a movie about it called 1942.
That's right.
It was a comedy. It was kind of like Animal House and Airplanes.
Belushi was in that, right?
People, right, exactly. And I think people saw that movie, and that kind of gave it a comic edge to it. But no investigation was ever done. But it's really a very, very dramatic case.
What happened to that UFO? Where did it go?
After it was caught and after this photo was taken, it just disappeared with the rest of them. I mean, up to two dozen of these objects were seen over L.A. at the height of this battle.
But, I mean, did they, like, take off in a high speed or what?
Just, you know, I don't want to use the word faded away. They flew off is how we've seen it described.
How about blinked off? Is that possible?
Well, maybe some of them did blink off, but it was just so confusing at the time because they figured that a million people saw these objects that night. And a lot of people, I mean, later on, there was speculation that they were, the Army actually speculated that they were airliners disguised, they were bombers disguised as airliners that had taken off from a base in Mexico and were being flown by the Japanese. Now, no bombs were dropped.
Well, but these were generally stationary up there, weren't they?
They were. Yep, they were moving in formation. They were moving in V formation, and then yes, they would hover. They were stationary. Yes. Yep. You know, a little bit of both. And later on, after the war was over, the U.S. military went to the Japanese and they asked them, you know, did you have anything to do with this incident over Los Angeles? And they said no. And they knew that they were telling the truth because they would have, I mean, this whole idea that the Japanese had a secret base in Mexico and were disguising airliners, you know, bombers to look like airliners, just never panned out. And the Japanese didn't have an aircraft carrier that had the endurance to come to the west coast of the United States, launch an attack, and then sail back.
That's
right. It's just impossible.
The only thing they tried, I think, during that era was to launch balloons that they tried to land.
That's right. They'd launch balloons that would have incendiary devices on them and try to start fires in the Pacific Northwest.
That's right. Exactly. Back to the Foo Fighters for a moment. Did the Japanese and the Germans talk about Foo Fighters? Did they see them too? Did their pilots run into them or just us?
We found evidence of German pilots definitely saw them. And
they probably thought we had them.
Well,
we thought they had them.
That's exactly what the case was that especially in the European theater, where the Allies were in the position of, their position was, we have to win this war, and especially, you know, with the air forces of England and the United States. Their mission was just to bomb Germany into submission. And when the aircraft crews came back and said, you know, in addition to us bombing our target, we are seeing these strange airplanes, aircraft, following us of all descriptions, shapes, and sizes, the intelligence officers of the air forces, they're in a quandary. They didn't have the time or the wherewithal to investigate what these things were. Their main focus was on winning the war. So everyone kind of said they must be German super weapons. And when the war is over, you know, if we win, we'll find out what these things are. But then when the war was over, and they went in and talked to the Germans, the Germans basically said to them, we thought that they were your wonder weapons.
That is an amazing story, too. And, you know, they were saying, what were some of the biggest Foo Fighters that people witnessed?
Physically?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a case called Ray Smith. The Ray Smith incident was pretty famous back then. He was a Canadian pilot. He was flying a British bomber with a Lancaster bomber with a crew of five.
Okay.
And they had just got through bombing Essen when this huge craft just came out, was flying behind them, came out in front of them, and flew in formation with them. And once again, it was cigar-shaped, brightly lit, enormous size, and it just flew in formation with them as they were passing over the city. And that was probably the most dramatic Foo Fighter example from the war. He went back to his base. He told his intelligence officers about it, but yeah, they basically said, okay, we're aware of it. Don't talk anymore about it. That was the MO of the intelligence officers was, okay, we're aware of it, but, you know, go about your business of winning the war. We're going to find out what these things are later on, and, of course, we never did.
And there were too many cases, Mac, for people just to be making them all up.
Right. I mean, that's kind of like the premise of the book is that, you know, so many of these UFO sightings are made by people who are, you know, in the middle of combat, and they're fighting for their lives in many cases, and that's probably the last instance where you would make up a flying saucer story. So that's why I believe that these people are the best witnesses we have to UFO sightings, because they're in a position of they're not in a position to be, you know, making it up or playing a hoax or whatever. I mean, they're fighting for their lives, and they're just in this strange situation where, while they're in combat, a UFO shows up. So you just wouldn't make up a story like that. It's not in our nature to do that.
I've also got to believe that somewhere in the archives, some pilot, some co-pilot, some crew member must have had a camera there, Mac, on one of these flights, and they must have an incredible series of pictures hidden away.
Yes, I agree 100%. In fact, we have we found a story where Churchill supposedly was shown a photo of a Foo Fighter that had been trailing a British reconnaissance airplane. And this photo was so graphic and so clear that Churchill ordered it to be quarantined for 50 years. And, of course, it turned out to be longer than that because he thought he was sure that this was not of this earth. And he felt that all religion would go down the drain if we found out that there were people on other planets coming here to, you know, watch us as we were just coming here.
Yeah, he thought people would, you know, disregard government and everything else.
Right, it'd be chaos. And there's also instances from the Pacific Theater, which you don't hear very much about as far as Foo Fighters, but there were a lot of them. And we got a lot of stories from a friend of mine's book. Keith Chester wrote a book called Strange Company, which is the book on Foo Fighters. And I suggest anyone who's interested in this to go and look that up. It's a great book. And he had a story in there where the USS New York, which was a battleship, was in the Pacific, and a UFO was spotted coming on radar, coming towards them, and it stopped and hovered right over this battleship plus its two destroyer escorts and stayed with it, paced it for 4 hours as it sailed. Now, you know, it couldn't have been an aircraft because no aircraft could go that slow, and it couldn't be a balloon because no balloon would be able to stay, you know, on the exact course as these ships. And everyone on the battleship saw it. Everyone on the destroyer escort saw it. In fact, at one point, they tried firing at it, but to no effect. But as someone pointed out to me recently, every major capital ship in the Navy of World War II, or even now, always has a photographer. They have a crew photographer and a crew, you know, who has a movie camera. So
that's right.
There must be film of this incident and many, many more somewhere locked away in some, you know, safe somewhere. Whether we'll ever see it or not, who knows? But yes, you're right. I mean, there must be probably hundreds of photos of these things, and probably a lot of movie footage too.
Well, you know, later we'll open up the phone lines. There aren't many World War II veterans left anymore. I just lost my father on Friday, so that's another one that has gone. But maybe they might call in later, Mac, when we open up the lines, and who knows? They might have stories. They might have some proof, some evidence. I would love to see that, wouldn't you?
Oh, would I ever? I heard from someone who had seen your website yesterday who told me that their father was a air raid warden during the L.A. battle, the Battle over L.A., and that his father actually found a piece of, or traded away for a piece of one of the UFOs, he said.
You mentioned briefly Ghost Rockets of 46. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, the Ghost Rockets of 46 were, once again, over Sweden, over the same area where the Ghost Flyers were. It was after World War II, things, you know, people had hoped they had settled down. The Foo Fighters had gone away. And then all of a sudden, people started seeing these rockets going over Sweden. And they described them as, it was always the same description. They were long, tubular, 12 to 15 feet long, sometimes they had wings, sometimes they had a small tail section, but they were definitely rockets. And people would see them flying in formation. They would see them two or three at a time. They saw them doing maneuvers. They saw them taking turns, things of this nature. But there were hundreds of these things, and thousands of people saw them. So the Swedish government got very concerned, and they secretly broke their neutrality law and asked the British for some air defense radar. The British sent them radar. Once the radar stations were set up, these things started showing up on radar as well. So now we have people on the ground seeing them, but also these electronic eyes seeing them as well. And it went on for this entire year into the summer of 1946. And it got so concerning that the Swedish government asked for U.S. help. And Jimmy Doolittle, who was the hero of the 30 Seconds of Tokyo raid, secretly went to Sweden. He was working for the Shell Oil Company at the time. That was his cover. Mm-hmm. But he actually talked to the Swedish defense authorities, and they told him, we think that these things are not of this earth. And that's the first instance that we came upon where a national government actually thought, you know, these things were from outer space or from somewhere else. At one point, they thought that they might have been coming from Peenemünde, which was the Nazis' base where they were launching and developed the V-1 and V-2 buzz bombs. But that was in Russian hands at the time. It was desolated because the Germans had destroyed a lot of the equipment when they were retreating from the Russians. So the Peenemünde theory kind of went down the drain pretty quickly. And once again, people never really came to an explanation of them. Towards the end of that summer, a Swedish Air Force pilot did catch up with one of these things and saw it just displaying all kinds of, like, incredible maneuvers and had almost terrain guidance technology and so on and so forth. And his description of it is the description that everyone was seeing. Once again, long tubule with small wings. Later on in the 1980s, one of the Swedish defense ministers was interviewed about this, and his quote was, from everything he saw, both secret and, you know, public, it appeared that cruise missiles were flying over Sweden in 1946. But as he asked, who had cruise missile technology in 1946?
Did you come across anything about submerged UFOs?
There's a couple stories in the book. At the end of World War II, a supply ship delivering supplies up to the Aleutian Islands, there was 14 people on the supply ship, and they saw this enormous orb come out of the ocean just about a mile off of the starboard side of their ship. It came out of the ocean. It circled their ship a couple times, and these people were just amazed at this thing, and then took off at high speed to the south. That was such a dramatic sighting that the 14 people on the ship later signed an affidavit saying that this thing had happened. There was also another instance earlier in the war where a Australian pilot came upon a UFO that he could actually saw a canopy and someone inside wearing a helmet, though he couldn't see their face. They flew in formation beside each other for a little while, and then this UFO all of a sudden just dove and went right into the Pacific and deep down and was lost. So, you know, there are a lot of theories, as you know, that, you know, these things may actually be USOs, that they're from the ocean, because there's a lot of deep parts in the ocean, a lot of places to hide down there.
Well, that's right. Where do we get the book, UFOs in Wartime, Mac?
Well, it came out today, and you can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com to order it, or you just bookstores everywhere. It's by Penguin Books, and it's at bookstores starting today.
Okay, more as we get into Vietnam, the Korean War, and some other cases, plus we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM.